Hey friends, welcome to episode number 33. Today we are joined by award-winning public speaker, New York Times best-selling author, and world-renowned health expert, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. You may also know her as the Paleo Mom. Now she has her PhD in medical biophysics and is just an absolute brilliant mind altogether. Now in this episode, Sarah teaches what foods are meant for human consumption and which foods are not. We then discuss what the impact is on a child's health and their cognitive development, their behavior, as well as their long-term health outlook if we neglect to teach them proper nutritional habits. The rest of the episode is then dedicated to practical tips to change the way children, or even yourself, eat, how they deal with societal norms of unhealthy eating, as well as when it's okay to let them eat whatever they want. You know, this isn't a perfect world that we live in, but in a world where chronic disease and behavior disorders are absolutely skyrocketing, especially in young children, this information becomes more and more important. So I really hope you guys take something from this episode and can apply it back to your life and your family's life. Now, if you're struggling to eat healthy and understand which foods you should be eating or what meals and recipes to be making, then I highly recommend you check out the new holistic cooking show called Cooking with Brashley. It's a show that's on YouTube that comes out weekly, where a husband and wife team have a lot of fun teaching not just new healthy recipes, but also why you should be using certain ingredients, how to cook foods so you maintain the nutritional properties, how to store and prepare your foods, and which foods to buy organic. The list goes on and on. It's a fun and entertaining show, but it's also super informative. I've never seen a cooking show quite like it. You can find it by typing in Cooking with Brashley or just going to the HealthSimple YouTube channel and subscribing there so you get each show each week. I'll also leave the link in the show notes here, but they've already got episodes out with sweet potato brownies, which are by far my favorite, cauliflower crust pizza, and even sushi bowls. The foods they make are by far the most delicious and nutritious out there. I should know. I every once in a while attend when they cook these meals, and they are mouthwatering and super healthy. So check out the show. If you go over there, leave a comment and let them know that you came from the podcast. And if there's any questions you have or meals you want them to make, just comment and they'll do it for you. They have a blast doing this. And, you know, Brad and Ash have the same mission as I do with HealthSimple Radio, and that's to help you live healthy, happy, and stress-free. The only difference is that they do it through cooking tips. So check them out on YouTube, and in the meantime, enjoy this next episode. Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to the HealthSimple Show. I'm your host, Kyle Reedhead, and I interview health and wellness experts from around the world to help you live healthy, happy, and stress-free. Enjoy the next show. So Dr. Sarah Ballantyne is one of the great minds in the nutrition and wellness space. So we're very lucky to have her join us today on HealthSimple Radio. So first of all, Sarah, welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us on live and through the recording.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Yeah. So Sarah, do you mind just sharing a bit of your background for us?
Yeah. So my health journey and my sort of professional journey are very intertwined. So I have a background in medical research, but I was going to grad school doing a PhD in medical biophysics at the same time as my health was like completely falling apart. I was morbidly obese. I had all of the like metabolic syndromes that you sort of associate with being obese. So, you know, high blood pressure, I was borderline diabetic. I had, you know, cholesterol was not awesome. But then I also had this like litany of other health challenges. I had chronic tendinitis and carpal tunnel syndrome and irritable bowel syndrome and gastroesophageal reflux disease and asthma and allergies and all kinds of skin things, eczema and cystic acne. And I had a couple autoimmune skin conditions, psoriasis and lichen planus, and always dry skin. And it turned out that I had fibromyalgia, which explained all the chronic joint pain. And then it turned out that I had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which explained the chronic fatigue. And so I had this, like, I was like falling apart. And then I'm like this super stubborn, focused, We're, I mean, not like just strong work ethic, but like workaholic. Like I was going to get a PhD, and I ended up doing like a you know, just fascinating research. I studied basically what happens in the immune system in intensive care units, where the immune system goes crazy because whatever the stimulus is that got someone there is so high, and then the immune system ends up attacking the body, and you end up with organ damage, eventually leading to multiple organ failure syndrome. So like cool stuff that didn't feel very relevant to me at the time, other than I was interested in doing research. But as I've pieced everything together later, I'm like, wow, I was studying the immune system going crazy, which was exactly what was happening in my body. My immune system was attacking my tissues. It just wasn't the result of an injury. It was the result of an autoimmune disease. So I ended up, my health ended up forcing me into a break from research. So I was finishing up my second postdoctoral research fellowship. I had a baby. My baby didn't sleep. It was super colicky. And I went, that though, can't, no, this is too much. Can't do this like academic career thing.
Two PhDs and a baby is quite a bit.
It's so much. So I was like, I can't put in the hours that an academic career requires in the current funding environment. So it's so competitive right now. There's so little grant funding to go around. I can't do those 60, 70, 80 hour weeks and be an engaged mom and have this very, very high needs baby who doesn't sleep and is obviously crazy bright already. And, you know, I can't balance these things. So I had, in that process, I had moved from Canada to the United States of America. And here in the US, there's a program run by the National Institutes of Health called Reentry Grants for Women. And what they do is they allow academics, so you have to have achieved a certain, you know, level of accomplishment to be able to qualify, which I had, to take up to 8 years off of their academic careers to do whatever, like they don't put a restriction on why. So it's whatever challenges that women have. So we often end up in caregiving roles. Sometimes that's children, sometimes that's aged parents. Some, you know, there's lots of reasons why women might need to take a break. And then the NIH pays for our reentry into academia. They pay salary for 3 years and some grant support, you know, some funding support for research as well, with the idea of like help. Women have so many barriers to careers in science. It's one of these programs that's designed to sort of equalize the playing field. So I'm like, I'm going to use this. Perfect. This is my thing. And taking that break, deciding that, okay, you know, I'm going to be a mom now. This is my focus is mom. It actually gave me the space to focus on me and really start looking at my collection of diagnoses as maybe this isn't all because I'm overweight. Like up until that point, I really thought that, oh, if I just lose weight, then everything will be, you know, magic, sunshine and unicorns and my life will be perfect. And suddenly I'll be a Hollywood star, right? Like that's the only thing holding me back. And so I was really then able to apply my research background and my scientific knowledge to the problem of my own health. And that brought me on this sort of circuitous journey towards the paleo community, the autoimmune protocol, functional medicine. But it really was, that was sort of the beginning. It was that decision to really focus on motherhood first and let my academic career take a break. And then kind of in that health journey, I sort of accidentally started a blog that accidentally became really popular. And then I accidentally wrote, you know, 4 books and made the New York Times bestseller list. And then when my 8 years was up 2 years ago, I had to go through this whole like, oh, what do I want to do? Do I want to leave this new thing that I'm doing that feels so important behind and go back in academia? Or do I want to make this breakup a permanent thing? And I decided that what I'm doing now, which is really my job, I think of my job now as like a science translator. I take all the super cool research that other people are dedicating their lives to, and I wrap it up in a package that is easy for the average person to understand and take action on. And I think that's a job that's really missing in our society right now. So we have researchers are doing really cool stuff and learning and advancing human knowledge. And then we have people who are living their day-to-day lives, and there's like no bridge in between those two worlds.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm one of that. I've got a little like rickety rope bridge over a chasm, and I'm trying to like get more people to help like make this bridge wider so that we can really help everyday people take that knowledge that's so exciting and apply it to their lives in a way that's going to make a real difference in their health. So it's really been a, you know, the academic career, a longstanding passion for scientific literacy, a longstanding passion for supporting women in science and women sort of breaking the molds of or sort of gender assigned roles for careers, and all of that kind of wraps into this thing that was really inspired by my personal journey and my search for answers for myself, and then my very nerdy, sciencey need to understand what's me, what is individual to me here versus what is generally applicable. So what's something that I need to do because this is my body versus something that really like everybody needs to know this thing. And then, okay, if everybody needs to know this thing, how do I communicate that so that everybody knows it?
Yeah. I love it. Super interesting. And you know, I love the idea of bridging the gap, because that was sort of the idea of me starting Health Simple as well. And starting this podcast was, you know, I would listen to all these podcasts of researchers and friends that I'm with. They're just sitting there like, I don't even know what they just said. This doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, really? Okay. So I have to explain it. I'm like, well, maybe we just need to simplify it and bridge this gap. So, you know, I'm on your team. I'm trying to do the exact same thing, because I think it is so important. Now, with all this knowledge that you have, I'm excited to sort of simplify this for our listeners. And I have sort of an avenue that I want to take with this episode here and kind of pick your brain on. But first, the question I get asked the most is, what foods are healthy? What foods are we supposed to eat, right? Because there's so many diets out there. You hear eggs are bad, then you hear they're good. You hear cholesterol's bad or it's good. And high fat, low carb, whatever it is. But, you know, in a simplified way, can you just help everyone to understand what foods humans are meant to eat?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of want to comment on a little bit about why this is such a confusing topic right now. And it's because there's so many voices that maybe shouldn't be voices that are contributing to this conversation. So it sort of starts with really the history of nutritional guidelines sort of starts in the early 20th century, where like people were legit starving. And the communication was purely centered on like what foods will give you enough calories that you will not starve. And that was 100% of the nutritional guidelines was like, it was literally like eat high fat, high sugar foods so that you get enough calories, right? That was, and it was to battle starvation, which was a real problem in North America at the time. It then evolved into, we're starting to understand nutrients, and we're going to create this 7 different food groups based on the nutrients these foods contain. And we're going to call it the basic 7, and we're going to make a little chart and like get everybody to eat it. And butter was its own food group, which is super cool. I feel really like proud of butter back then in 1946. But it was like, these foods had vitamin C. So like cabbage and tomatoes and citrus were all in a group, right? Yeah. Based on our understanding of vitamin C. And the problem, the idea behind that was great. The problem was our understanding of nutrition was so rudimentary that you couldn't actually divide things into sensible groups. And there was no such thing as the internet back then. I know it's hard for people to understand life before the internet.
Difficult,
right? So communication, there was no ability to take the time and have a broader societal conversation around these guidelines. So people found it very confusing. So the reactionary thing was, okay, we're going to talk about 4 food groups. It's just going to be basically how food is grown. Butter, sorry, you no longer get your own food group. You're in there with dairy products and meat. And that was the guideline for decades. And then the food industry, like, right then there was this effort, right? We're going to create the food pyramid, right? We're going to update these guidelines. And the person who originally, the researcher who was tasked with go through the scientific research, figure out what an optimal human diet is and put it in diagram form, her original food pyramid had vegetables and fruit at the bottom. It had grains at the very, very top, because grains don't have a lot to offer nutritionally, and it had sort of meat in between, right? So it had grains up with sugar at the very, very top. It didn't look like what the food pyramid was. The explanation that she was given for why they changed it was, well, people can't afford all of those fresh fruits and vegetables. So there was never a food pyramid that's optimal for human health, and if you can't afford this, here's this other option, which might have saved a lot of people a lot of, you know, health problems, because those guidelines were really the beginning of health in Western countries in general, because it wasn't like America started it, but then Health Canada followed suit, and the guidelines in Australia followed suit, and the guidelines in Europe followed suit. Like, it was, if you look at all the guidelines from the 70s, 80s, and 90s from Western countries, they all have a lot more in common than they have differences.
Yeah.
And that was a combination of some research that was, fraudulent. When you throw out data because it doesn't fit your hypothesis, that's not science. It was a combination of that. It was a combination of the food lobby having a really, really strong voice in government policy, and some, you know, let's say a belief system by politicians and by scientists who were influencing the politicians in terms of, you know, what was the scourge of modern society in terms of diet. And so we have this system of dietary guidelines that got so far astray that they've really contributed to the rise in chronic illness, and that has led to this complete distrust of government guidelines and what your doctor says. Well, clearly my doctor's not going to be right in terms of government guidelines. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've had the rise of the internet, which is not quality controlled, and not everybody knows how to vet the information that they're getting on the internet, although that is a skill that young people are learning now, which I think is great. And now you've got an equal voice of everybody. And so we've got the government just, you know, being way too influenced by the food lobby, the drug lobby, and all of these things that are not actually, they don't actually have a, you know, communicate best dietary practices in mind, combined with everybody else saying whatever they want, putting a scientific reference on the bottom to make it look like it's legit, and then having an equal voice. And so it's so hard now to figure out what information is accurate information when it comes to diet. So as I add my voice to this, well, this is what I think is optimal diet, I'm going to try to couch it in like where science is now, because I'm not going to, you know, come on your podcast and say everyone needs to follow the paleo diet. I don't believe that. It works really well for me and my family, but we have some non-paleo foods that we include, and we have some paleo foods that we exclude. So we actually have sort of a modified version of it in my home. Okay. And so I think that when you look at scientific evidence and you look at diets that have therapeutic benefit, so that would be paleo, that'd be autoimmune protocol, but that would also be Mediterranean diet, that would also be plant-based diet. When you look at what all of those have in common, they all have high vegetable and fruit consumption in common. They all have seafood and lean meats in common. Just the amount, of course, obviously varies. They all have a focus on healthy fats. And they all almost accidentally have a focus on something called nutrient sufficiency. And this is what I think is actually the most important quality of any diet that's going to support health. And what that means is that from our food, from the food that we eat, we get all of the nutrients, both essential and non-essential, that all of the chemical reactions that are happening in our body in every single moment require, right? Those are the raw materials for chemical reactions. They're the building blocks for our tissues. So we need those nutrients. And some of them we burn through, mm-hmm. right? Some of them are energy. Some of them are used up in those chemical reactions. Some of them become structural. But we have this like daily requirement for vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, fiber, amino acids, fatty acids, and energy. And so what I see as being the number one quality of a health promoting diet is a diet that actually provides us adequate quantities and synergistic quantities. So we're getting the right relative quantities of these different nutrients, that we get all of those things from the food. And it turns out that when you start looking at food, just in terms of the nutrients that it provides, it's actually really challenging to get all of the nutrition that our bodies need on what a typical sort of Western country diet is, right? So a diet that looks like the food pyramid, or that looks like my plate, it's really, really hard to get all of those vitamins and minerals and essential amino acids and essential fatty acids and phytochemicals and fiber. So what actually adds up to that is a, I'm going to say, sort of plant-focused diet, right? So not exactly what the trademarked plant-based diet is, yeah, but a very veggie-focused diet. So my rule is 2/3 to 3/4 of every plate would be vegetables and fruit. And then high quality animal foods. So there's nutrients we get from plant foods that we can't get from animal foods, nutrients we get from animal foods that we can't get from plant foods. So then a modest sized portion of fish and shellfish are really, really important. They're super nutrient dense. It's really important to incorporate some organ meat, even though everyone on Instagram Live is about to hop off right now when I say that. But like high quality meat. So high quality meat actually is important for few reasons, because it has more nutrients, it has better fats, and it also ecologically and environmentally is very, very important for our planet to be embracing small farm agriculture, family farms, that sort of small scale meat. Mm-hmm. You know, our cows are living on you know, wild land, as opposed to living in a barn and fed corn that was grown on a monocrop, you know, 300 miles away. So it actually serves both purposes, right? It's better for the environment. And so on average, what that looks like as a shift from what people are typically eating is it looks like a shift towards more vegetables. So let vegetables displace grains, because grains don't have a lot of nutrients in them. And we actually get more and better fiber from vegetables. So the fiber in vegetables better supports a healthy gut microbiome, so all the bacteria living in our gut. It's wrapped up with more antioxidants, so that provides us with anti-inflammatory and anti-aging benefits. So generally we're getting more and better fiber from vegetables and between 10 and 100 times more vitamins and minerals than grains. So that shift, right, from instead of a dinner roll, we're going to have a sweet potato. Yeah. So that shift becomes really important. Embracing fruit as a source of sweetness as opposed to junk food, that becomes really important. And then actually for most people, it requires reducing meat consumption.
Yeah.
I fully embrace meat consumption. I advocate a serving of some kind of animal food at every single meal. So that's more meat than what the trademark plant-based diet would recommend. But still, if you look at sort of average intake, there's some really great statistics for the United States. If you look at average meat intake here, it's, you know, like 250 pounds of meat per year, plus 450 pounds of dairy products per year, plus about 16 pounds of seafood. It's like poor fish. It's mostly shrimp too. It's almost all shrimp. So like upping seafood, meat's probably not too far off, but like decreasing dairy, right? So like the animal protein, we're getting enough protein. We're getting all the nutrients. We're seeking the best quality of all of those things that we can get. Yeah. But then really balancing our plates, we can round out things with things like nuts and seeds. The cholesterol in eggs does not increase blood cholesterol. So we get to embrace eggs. Actually, egg yolks are a very, very rich source of a lot of really important B vitamins that are hard to get from other foods. So eggs are actually pretty great, but they're not that dense of a protein, right? An egg only has 7 grams of protein, and most adults probably need 40 to 50 grams of protein per meal, assuming 3 meals a day. And most kids probably need about half that. So, you know, that means a kid needs to eat 3 eggs and an adult needs to eat 6. And all of a sudden it's just easier to get protein from somewhere else. But that's, you know, like if you frame it that way, I mean, yeah, that looks a lot like paleo. It looks a lot like a plant-based diet with a little bit more meat than what those guidelines would naturally say. Mm-hmm. It looks very Mediterranean because of the focus on vegetables and seafood and, you know, olive oil, especially like a really high quality olive oil that's rich in polyphenols. It's got some great health benefits. So you start to see these sort of threads. So I really like to focus on the commonality between all of these dietary approaches rather than like hop on my horse and go, no, this one is right and everyone shall follow this dietary guideline. Because when you approach it that way and you think about, okay, well, here's the thematic elements that are really important. These are the things that are universally true for human health, then within that, you've got lots of room to experiment and figure out, you know, what is best for me as an individual or best for my child as an individual. And once you can embrace, right, you've got this, hey, I'm going to try and get all the nutrients I need from diet. And now I'm going to evaluate, well, you know, are we sensitive as a family to gluten? Because not everybody is. But, you know, in my family, it's a no-go. We don't even have it in the house. Even my fish food is gluten-free because I don't want to touch gluten. But it makes us all violently ill. So it's right. That's us. But not every family needs to go to that extreme. So you get to really experiment with these other aspects of diet in terms of how they impact each individual in the household, and you get to respect bioindividuality, which I think is missing right now in dietary guidelines as a whole. The idea that we all have the exact same optimal diet is obsolete.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. And I think the one thing to just simplify things for everyone is don't worry about the type of diet or the amount of fat or carbs or any of that kind of stuff. Before any of that, you just need to eat real food, like you've explained, your veggies, your fruits, your animal meats, your fish. And then at that point, then, as you said, you can start to experiment and see, you know, if maybe a higher fat diet works better, or maybe a higher carb works better, you know, whatever it is. But just eat real food to start, get rid of all the crap that's not supposed to be in our bodies, and then go from there. But for the most part, whether you're looking to lose weight, improve your health, whatever it is, that should be the starting point.
Yep.
Always, always.
And that doesn't also mean that a healthy diet doesn't make room for treats, yep. Right? Like a healthy diet can still include a slice of birthday cake or an occasional cookie, right? Sometimes that means changing around the ingredients to use healthy ingredients. And sometimes it just means, look, if the overall quality of my diet is really great and I'm getting enough sleep and I'm active and I'm managing my stress and I have a good, strong sense of community and I spend time in nature, these are also all really important things for health.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to tolerate something that's suboptimal once in a while. And that's a really important, right? That gives people the flexibility. I don't want it to be permission to not make changes. But the flexibility, I think, is really important, because the idea here is to make the best choice as often as possible for the rest of our lives. And if we set ourselves up with this rigid structure, that means we can't follow that. We're going to be on the wagon, off the wagon. We're going to be, with Halloween, and then we're just going to go on this roller coaster for the next 2 months of like all the terrible stuff, right? That doesn't set us up to experience the health benefits of an overall healthy diet. So. Yeah. Being able to give ourselves permission to find the wiggle room, to be human. You know, as humans, we celebrate with food. We socialize, we social bond with food. We nurture with food, right? These are things that are ingrained in our psychology. It's not just that thing's yummy and I want to eat it with my friends. Like, it goes back to actually like primate societal structures are also centered around food, just like ours are. So it's sort of natural to want to have birthday cake or, you know, meet someone for coffee. Like, those are things that are part of our way that we connect with other humans. So we can troubleshoot and find healthier ways to do those things.
Yeah.
But also when we sort of look at diet more holistically, and look at it in the context of, I want to be as healthy as I can be for as long as I can, then we start to see that it really matters what the average is over time.
Yeah.
Not what, you know, not that I indulged and I had that, you know, whatever it is, cookie today.
Yeah. Well, you have to earn your treats. You have to earn your bad foods. That's how I look at it. And it's funny because I go home and my parents, you know, they have, let's say, a treat that's their cookie, let's say. And they go, oh, can you eat that? Is that something you can eat? And I go, hell yeah, I can eat that. I've earned that cookie. You know what I mean? Like, I've ate perfect all week, so I can eat that. You can't, because you haven't earned it. That's the way that it should be, right? You know,
people do that in different ways, right? They'll have a cheat meal, or they'll have a point system, right? There's a lot of different ways that people can structurize earning something. I don't think it always needs to be structured.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right in the sense of, right. My choices are excellent. Therefore, my body is just going to tolerate a bad choice better once in a while. Exactly. Whereas if my choices are all overall pretty terrible, that additional terrible choice is just adding to this muck of ugh.
Yeah. Now, and that leads me right into what I wanted to talk about. And so It's very common that we eat the Western type diet, which is full of refined grains and sugars and processed foods, essentially.
Oxidized fats and
Exactly. And I mean, I think as we age, we start to notice our health kind of break down, and that's typically when you start to go, okay, I should probably start exercising and eating healthier. But what sort of impact does this have on a child, on a younger developing brain, a younger developing body? What kind of impact does eating sugar and processed foods have on them? Because I think that's something that's not talked about enough.
Yeah, it's a huge impact, and we see it directly reflected in health statistics in children and teenagers now. So, and this is not just the obesity epidemic, right? But we're seeing now children, toddlers, are becoming morbidly obese at a rate that has never existed in human history before. Mm-hmm. We're seeing diabetes, type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes. That used to be the term. We didn't call them type 1 and type 2. We called them juvenile diabetes, which was type 1. That's an autoimmune disease. And we called it adult onset diabetes. That's type 2. And we mostly saw it in sort of senior, right, 65 and older populations. Now we're seeing it at incredibly huge rates in young adults, in teenagers, and in children. So we've had to change the terminology around diabetes to reflect that. And that is a lifestyle disease. It is a direct result of diet and lifestyle combined, as is obesity, right? Obesity is a direct consequence. There's some hormonal things that can contribute, right? There's environmental exposures, the microbiome contributes. There's a lot of other factors going in, but it still boils down to how we're living our lives and the choices that we're making. So those environmental exposures, depending on where you live, you might not necessarily have control. There's a lot of other things that we do. Mm-hmm. Then we're also seeing things like the rates of ADHD, ADD, increase exponentially. We're seeing oppositional defiance disorder increasing exponentially. So we're also seeing these mental health challenges that kids are facing increase dramatically. And there's more and more research linking that to nutritional deficiencies and the gut microbiome. 60% of the composition of our gut bacteria is directly related to the foods we eat. The other 40% is medications, antibiotics, lifestyle, how active we are, how well we sleep, and toxin exposure. So if we're not eating a good diet, that is completely shifting our microbiomes in a way that is inflammatory, that our gut bacteria do things like produce neurotransmitters that impact our behavior and our mood. So we can draw these direct lines now between basically things like our ability to focus and pay attention in a classroom and the food that we're eating on, again, sort of on an average. This isn't I ate a cookie and therefore I couldn't sit still at school today.
Yeah.
It's the average diet because our microbiome it shifts over a few days, not over a few hours, right? So it's not every single meal, but it's the average. And so we're seeing it's reflected completely in the statistics that our children are faced with health challenges that we just didn't have when we were kids, and our grandparents certainly didn't have, right? This is a whole new thing, a whole new challenge. And it is very, very much related to diet and lifestyle. We have all of these societal sort of like idioms that kind of like reinforce parenting choices that are not good choices for our kids. So, I mean, we have things like video games and streaming services on TVs, and that didn't exist before. We have the entire world in our pockets, right? So we have those kinds of extra challenges. But we have, as a society, we have more dual income households. So as adults, we're spending more time indoors than we ever have before, and we're more stressed than we ever have before. But that's also happening to our kids, because instead of coming home and playing outside after school, kids are going to an after school program, or they're going to some kind of classes after school. And they're not necessarily getting that outside time, that free play time. And then we're having dinner really late, and then our kids are going to bed really late. So, I mean, this is not just diet. It's also the sleep patterns in general of society right now are really, really terrible. And it's even translating to kids. My kids, I have a 8-year-old and 11-year-old. My 8-year-old goes to bed at 7:30. and my 11-year-old goes to bed at 8:30. And of all of our peer group, none of their friends go to bed as early as my kids. And I'll often have like these conversations with parents of like, how do you get your kids to bed so early? I'm like, well, they don't wake up to an alarm. They wake up when it's time to go to school naturally because they just got enough sleep, and sleep's a real strong priority in our household. It's something that we make routine. And if they get invited to a birthday party that's at 8 p.m., the answer's no. Like, no, you cannot go to a birthday party at 8 p.m. That's too late. It's past your bedtime. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. You know, let's schedule a play date with that kid so you can still celebrate in some other way. So we've got all of these societal things, right? Oh, no kid likes green vegetables. It's a picky phase. And now there's like seven different picky phases that kids are supposed to go through, right? Like we've got all of these, it's not really an excuse so much as a societal reinforcement, so that as a society, we've dropped the bar so low in terms of the standards for diet and lifestyle for our kids that our average is terrible, all of us. And it reduces awareness of what that optimal should be.
Yeah.
So working toward, if you're a family, like my family, my kids eat 10 to 12 servings of vegetables and fruit a day.
Wow. Nice.
They eat organ meat. Their favorite dinner is, we call them liver burgers because they're not just liver. It's ground liver and ground beef mixed together, but I call them liver burgers to reinforce to my, we used to hide it. And then I was like, you know, there's liver in that, right? And then they were like, oh really? Cause it tastes great. And so now I'm like, well, I'm just going to call them liver burgers now so that you know that you're eating liver.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was a slow thing that happened over time. But they eat these diets that, like, my pediatrician is like so thrilled every time I go in and I fill out the little form of what they eat, because it's not like their peers. And people go like, how did you get that? How did you get your kids to eat that? And the answer is, I knew what my goal was and we worked slowly towards it. And as a society, if we don't have that goal of like, here's this optimal diet for kids to eat, here's this optimal, you know, lifestyle priorities for kids as well, then we don't have anything to work towards. So I think that's like number one, is just having that conversation of like, no, it's, kids do eat green things. Sometimes kids will even eat that green thing if it touches another thing on their plate. Like, we can actually like help our kids get beyond some of those picky things with play, with positive reinforcement, with familiarity. There's a lot of psychological studies showing how important this is for kids. So I really just think like number one is the goal, right? Here's where we want to be, and then give ourselves permission to not, you know, force our children to all of a sudden change everything that they're doing in one day.
I love it. And I want to talk a little bit about some practical steps with children, but I just want to go back more to some of the research surrounding, you know, eating the bad way, we'll call it, or the typical way, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, when I speak to them, they say, well, you know, my son or my daughter isn't obese. They don't have diabetes. You know, they do participate in sports. So in my mind, they're relatively healthy. But what you kind of mentioned is that, you know, eating sugar and eating processed foods often can, you know, it's not that it just causes disease, but it can impede their ability to learn and their ability to grow, which is obviously super, super important as a young child with a developing brain. Can you sort of, is there any actual research to show the difference of someone who eats a healthy diet versus someone who eats the, you know, the modern Western diet? Is there anything particular that you can think of, or is there anything you can, any way you can explain that further?
So there's not great studies comparing different. So I guess part of the challenge is in medical research, how you define a healthy diet is highly variable.
Yeah.
So there are some studies that look at cognition. It's typically more done in teenagers and adolescents, because there's a lot of interesting neuropsychiatry research done in adolescents. And then also it can be done in adults, or, you know, we see it in dementia research as well,
yeah,
where you will look, and sometimes it's as simple as one nutrient. If they have this one nutrient, like fish oil, there's a lot of fish oil studies,
yeah,
looking at psychological and cognitive impact of fish oil. And it's like always good. There's never a situation where more long chain omega-3s is bad. So I would say the ideal study that says take these kids and randomize, no change to their diet versus put these kids on this healthier diet and then look at their grades and give them some, you know, cognitive tests to figure out how their problem solving and memory is, and then, you know, go, haha, see, if they eat vegetables, they're gonna get A's in school. Like that study does not, to my knowledge, exist.
Yeah.
And so right now we have to base it based on the pieces that we have. So we have a lot of pieces showing the importance of high vegetable consumption. We have a lot of pieces showing the individual nutrients in vegetables and what those individual nutrients do. We have a lot of pieces showing adequate protein is important, a lot of pieces showing high omega-3s, and not flaxseed omega-3s, but like fish omega-3s are really important. And then we have certain nutrients that we know are really key for development, and especially neurological development. And some of those are nutrients that as a society we're extremely deficient in. So best example is zinc, right? Zinc is phenomenally important for development. It is the second most abundant mineral in the human body after iron. 73% of people over the age of 2 in America never meet the RDA of zinc.
Jeez.
So it's basically 3/4 of us are deficient in zinc. But zinc drives neurological development. It drives growth. It actually is super important for immune function. So being chronically depleted in zinc, oh, and zinc is also a regulator of sleep patterns as well. So being deficient in zinc, you're not going to sleep well. You're going to hamper neurological development. You're going to hamper growth in general, and you're going to be more easily inflamed. And so we can take those sorts of pieces and put them together and form this bigger picture. And then hopefully eventually dietary studies are sort of notoriously difficult to perform because compliance issues are so high. And people will tell you, oh yeah, I follow the diet that you told me. And meanwhile, they so ate those, you know, chicken nuggets or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So dietary, you know, just comparing different diets, there is more research happening now, but it's still early days in terms of that type
perfect
research. So we're still in this, like, take these bits and pieces and try to make a picture. And there might be, right, it's like putting together a puzzle and you might be missing a few pieces. And we just have to wait for those studies to be done to be able to put those pieces into the puzzle. And I think that what we can do with that research now is we can look at the universal truths, nutrient sufficiency, universally true, high fiber, universally true. And then the pieces that are missing, those pieces, a lot of those translate to bioindividuality. So that's where I go back to, like, maybe your kid doesn't need to be gluten-free, but maybe they do, and you're not really going to know until you try it, because there's many ways that we can react to foods that we have no capacity to test for. So an elimination and challenge diet is still the gold standard for identifying food sensitivities. Yeah, we don't have that, like, here's the proof of the better grades and the higher focus. It'd be wonderful, right? Because then you just say, hold up this one paper and then tell everyone, just go.
Yeah.
Everyone just go. And that's maybe one of the reasons why setting these lofty goals in terms of optimal diet is so challenging.
Yeah.
The other aspect to that is, even if you don't see health issues in a child, you're still teaching them habits that are going to carry forward with them into adulthood. So if that child learns that, well, as long as I go play soccer after school, then I can eat candy and chips and soda, you know, and whatever it is, you know, I see this very often in the sports that my kids do. There's a lot of other families that treat sports as you're buying your junk food, right? You're very active and therefore you get to eat all of this sugar. And meanwhile, what we see happen with adults grow up is the sugar stays and the activity will tend to drop off. But even in very, very active adults who are eating that much sugar, that can cause problems. And where it hits you is very dependent on genetics. It's dependent on the other lifestyle things. So sleep and stress management, activity, obviously. And we'll see it. Some people, their bodies are super resilient to bad choices. Yeah. And they're lucky in that way, except that when it hits them, it typically hits them really hard. And we have these diseases that we associate with old age, right? Arthritis, diabetes, Oh yeah, I must be getting old. I'm just getting so forgetful, right? So sort of cognitive deficits, memory deficits, that sort of leads to early dementia. We have all of these diseases. Oh, my joints hurt. Oh, my knees aren't the way they used to be, right? All these things. None of those are related to the normal aging process. They are all related to inflammation. They're all inflammatory processes, and inflammation is caused by our diet and lifestyle, and sometimes genetics, right? Genetics do contribute to how easily stimulated our immune system is.
Yeah.
But we have this, like, you know, oh yeah, this is just what happens when you get old. You know, oh, I'm going to need glasses when I turn 40, right? We have all of these things that, you know, it's just, we expect them to happen, and we just, oh yeah, aging's terrible. It's the worst thing. At least I'll get to retire someday, right? Like, and meanwhile, those are all related to the sum of our diet and lifestyle choices over the decades preceding. So if we can take a child and teach them better lifelong habits now, that doesn't mean they're always going to make good choices, sadly. They still might do something that's not a good choice. That is sort of a rite of passage through adolescence into adulthood, of course. But if we can teach them, here's what this average should be, here's what this goal should be, they have a much higher likelihood of having a healthy adulthood, because those habits are so ingrained from childhood on that even when they're faced with, here's the sugary cereal aisle at the grocery store, and I've got my own money now to spend on it, you know, they're still likely to maybe rebel a little bit, but eventually come back to those habits that they were raised with.
I love that you talked about the habit side of things, because that really is so important. And, you know, we teach our kids manners. We teach our kids how to be social, because we know that this is all things that are going to help them later in life, but we don't teach them. And I mean, it's not necessarily the parents' fault, because they went through a time where they were told all the wrong things for nutrition, but we should know, and somewhat do know now. But we just don't teach them proper nutrition. And like you said, that we do know that has long-term effects, right? Yes. There's a lot of studies on that. There may not be for, you know, cognitive performance at a young age, but we know if we're teaching those habits and they continue that throughout life, we're setting them up for, you know, issues, health issues. So exactly. It really should be something that we start at such an early age. And you know, you're not necessarily depriving them of foods. It's what they're meant to eat. That's just what I want people to understand. It's like, we weren't meant to eat all these other cereals and things. Those didn't exist back in the day, right? Like, those aren't human. That's not human food. Now, the other issue with it too is that, and this kind of goes with the habits, is that these types of foods are made to be addictive, right? Mm-hmm. So sugar itself is addictive, but processed foods, chips, all these things are actually designed to be addictive. And like you said, you know, when all of a sudden the kids leave home, they may rebel for a bit. And I know I saw going through college and university, all of a sudden half the people just blew up, you know what I mean? Cause they didn't know.
I was one of yeah. them.
Yeah. They didn't know what to eat. Right. And so it's so important to start it, you know, at an earlier age. Can you sort of talk about that addictive, properties of these foods too, just so we know why, you know, we don't want to be putting them into our daily habits and our daily meals?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe that food companies are intentionally making their food more addictive to make us unhealthy because they're collaborating with the pharma and the right. Like, I don't believe that. I do believe they're trying to make us want to buy more of their food, and they're trying to make it as delicious as possible so that they can get a bigger market share. That's just capitalism, right? That's not conspiracy. Yeah.
That's the U.S. dream. Sorry,
living the dream. what we see that companies are doing is they're literally hiring scientists who are specialists in, you know, the psychological reactions to various flavor stimuli, and they're developing food to maximize basically our dopamine response. So it's basically maximizing our reward response to that food. And we are wired, we're hardwired to seek out energy-rich food, because for several million years of evolution, that gave us a survival edge. It's only now that high energy food also is completely devoid of nutrition. If you're talking about a high energy, you know, high calorie food that also has tons of vitamins and minerals and fiber and all these other great things, it's not going to be bad for us. We could still overdo it, sure, because it's still, we're not picking it off the tree ourselves anymore, right? Like, it's, our access to it is obviously a lot different than it was historically speaking. But it still doesn't trigger that same type of reward response. And so what would happen is, in with these types of, they're called hyper palatable foods, which means they're like super tasty, right? Hyper, super palatable, tasty. They're super tasty foods. But they're, that hyper palatable means, right? It means that it's so tasty that it's addictive, because it drives this dopamine response. And what happens is, we have such a huge release of dopamine in the brain because this thing is so, so good, that our receptors, it's like insulin resistance. So when you have a lot of insulin in your body, because you're eating all the sugar, your cells will actually make it themselves more resistant to the signals of insulin, either by decreasing the number of receptors to insulin they have in their cell membranes, or decreasing some kind of intracellular signaling when that insulin binds with the receptor, right? So we have different ways that our cells can like blunt the effects of insulin.
Yeah.
We have that same thing happen with recurring consumption of these high reward foods. Then we're not as sensitive to dopamine, so we don't get the same reward response from an apple anymore, right? An apple cannot compete with a salted chocolate glazed donut, right? Like, it's just, it's not the same. It's not the same thing. And it doesn't trigger the same dopamine response once we've sort of dulled,
it's like
basically increased our expectations.
It's like a natural athlete versus an athlete who's using performance enhancing drugs. they can't compete. They can't compete.
Yeah. It's not the same thing, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and what's really fascinating, here's where the intersection is with lifestyle, is that the changes in dopamine receptors that we see in food addiction, we see the same changes in dopamine receptors in other forms of addiction. So we see that in alcoholism, in drug addiction, in smoking. So it is a form of addiction. That same change in dopamine receptors is also driven by sleep deprivation. So in a society now where we're getting an hour and a half to 2 hours less sleep a night than most of us need on average, which is crazy.
Yeah.
We're basically starting the changes in the brain that are permissive to developing addiction. And we actually, you know, you can see that in other fields, right? You can see that drug addicts are more likely to relapse if they face sleep deprivation. Wow. But there's probably also a link to food deprivation. And then to make things even more like intensely interesting, but also complicated from a children's perspective, adolescents are one of the things that's happening in their brain. So they really have some very, very unique neurological processes happening that is different from children and different from adults. And one of them is an intensified dopamine response. So they actually literally get even more of a dopamine response to some kind of reward stimulus. It's that dopamine response is why addiction behaviors tend to start in adolescence, which goes from 10 to 12 all the way up to about 25, right? That transition period from child to adult. It's why we see food addiction and weight problems tend to start during that time period. Yeah. That's also, right, that's the same processes that is driving thrill seeking and sort of dangerous type behavior, right? Because the reward, and it changes for an adolescent, it changes cost benefit analysis because the reward is so great. So that drives risk taking. So all of those things are linked. And, you know, the solution here is to cold turkey the hyper palatable foods, right? Like those never make it into my mouth anymore. There was a time. But then, you know, it's, you know, basically like rehab for Doritos, right? So, but it's getting rid of that stimulus is really, really important for regulating our neural response to food and getting enjoyment from healthy food. So if you don't have it's fast food, it's processed food, it's basically almost anything in a box, right? Anything that you pop one and you just can't stop, or whatever the right, whatever the little motto is for that food. If the motto is, right, they're great, then maybe that's not a great food in
Yeah.
terms of being able to enjoy an apple or a banana. Like ideally, an apple should be like this wonderful sweet treat. This is so delicious. I'm eating this apple. And it really takes cleaning out all of those other foods to be able to enjoy that apple. Now, getting back to treats, if you make a cake at home, it is not the same formula of salt, sugar, fat as a cake that you buy in the store. And
Good
it
point.
is not as addictive, even if you're making it with white sugar and white flour. Obviously, it's better if you use more sort of whole food ingredients. But even in that circumstance, it is not going to be the same type of super addictive food. It is going to be a higher dopamine response food than an apple.
Yep.
So obviously, we don't want to make homemade cake every week, but it is going to be a million times better than whatever we're buying at the store. So one of the huge secrets here, like you mentioned, going back to whole foods, I think the bigger secret is going back to the kitchen and
Yeah.
actually just making stuff ourselves. I think that is one of the biggest missing pieces right now in terms of how our societal structure is supporting health. And if we can get back to cooking, and that doesn't have to mean we spend 2 hours a day in the kitchen, right? The Environmental Working Group has done some really interesting studies where they've compared the amount of time it takes to get dinner at a fast casual restaurant compared to the amount of time it takes to cook a meal, and you save time cooking at home.
Yeah,
Like that, it's
definitely.
faster to cook at home, and cheaper.
Yeah, I was
It's
just
also
gonna
like a
say,
quarter of the
cheaper too.
price. So there have been some really interesting like comparisons of, how long, the time commitment and the budget. We save time and money when we cook at home. It's just something that's really unfamiliar for a lot of people now
Yeah.
because we grew our generation, right? We grew up with the rise of fast casual restaurants and the rise of fast food and how like when McDonald's went from being a treat to a legitimate dinner option when
Yeah.
we're busy, right? Like that transition happened just over the last couple of decades. And so trying to find our way back to no, like most of the meals we eat, we cook at home. And if we can just make that change, that's already going to create an environment that is permissive for all of those other changes.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, if you think of when you go back to the addiction side of things, you think of, we don't give kids alcohol. We don't let them
No.
smoke at a young age,
Yeah.
and we don't give them caffeine because, they're addictive. And a lot of those things, smoking alcohol and that is bad for you. And
Right.
I think, we need to have that same mindset with sugar and processed foods. It's addictive and we know it's not good for you. So why are we teaching our kids to start eating it at such an early age, right? If we don't
Love
let them
that.
have alcohol in that, then we need to do the same with sugar. Now, here's where it gets really, really difficult. And you sort of touched on it with the politics of food. You turn on a TV and you have all the commercials of all these different processed foods because the food companies have some of the best form of marketing there is. They put cartoon characters on the boxes, they put games on it, you get toys when you buy food, there's play places at McDonald's, all the stuff. So how do you compete? What is your advice for competing with all of that and trying to get your kids to still eat, healthy when they watch TV and that's what they see, or they go to the grocery store and it's just aisles and aisles of the best form of marketing there is?
Right. So my strategy that I use in my home is communication. So I see all of those challenges as being an opportunity to talk about the way that we eat and why with my kids. And that doesn't mean that 100% of the time we're not going to give in to that amazing marketing ploy. So like
Yeah.
let's just start with like sometimes the marketing is really amazing. So it requires I'm on the same journey as my kids, right? Like this is also my health journey. I am trying to recover from all of the damage that my list of diagnoses caused my body in my teens and 20s and early 30s. I'm trying to recover so that I can live the healthiest life that I can and hopefully extend my lifespan now. And I'm trying to teach my kids those same habits so
Yep.
that they also can hopefully avoid the challenges with health that I've had to go through, despite the fact that they've got half of my genetics. So I take it as an opportunity to to talk, and I do it from a very compassionate standpoint. Oh yeah, that really does look good. You know, oh man, they're really smart the way they're telling us about how good that cake is, because that's really working. I really think that would be a good cake. But you know what? You know, cake has, and then we can talk about, I usually pick one thing, right? Cake has this ingredient that's really not good for our bodies, right? It's so much better if cake has, you know, so much sugar, and it, you know, that you know how you love berries? Berries aren't going to taste the same if you get to eat that cake. And those berries, they have this and this and this. You know what? Let's get a treat, but let's go get some of those delicious strawberries over there. So sometimes I see it as an opportunity, right? An opportunity to explain, because I feel like if I impose a diet from on high on my children, then I'm not teaching them anything that's going to carry into adulthood. I want them to understand why we eat the way we eat and understand that the treat is okay, but dessert every night isn't, right? That's no longer a treat. If it's every day, that's your average diet, right? Yeah. That's your routine. So we can have a treat once a week, right? Like that's an okay time frame for having some kind of indulgence. And what are we going to have? Like, oh, you know, what special thing can we make at home? Oh, hey, that cake looks really good. Let's go make a cake at home. Maybe it's as simple as that, right? Maybe it's as simple as, oh yeah, that would be great. I bet we can make something even better, right? So sometimes I try to always channel it in a very positive way. I try to take it as an opportunity to talk about nutrients, to talk about processed food ingredients. I don't do a lot of talking about marketing, but sometimes it does sort of end up in that space of, you know, wow, like that's really effective. Well, look at that, you know, cartoon tiger. I want to be his friend. I wonder if I can be his friend without buying that box of cereal. Right. Yeah. Like, so we can, to me, it becomes a conversation, and I try never to dismiss it. If I'm just the one with the willpower in the grocery store who's not buying it, they're not learning anything at that time. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is over the years, because we started changing how we were eating just about 7 years ago, over the years, my kids now engage with those types of conversations with their friends. As much as I tell them it's not their job to educate their friends, if their friends are over at the house and I'm serving apples for a snack instead of something else, my kids will come up with like, apple facts, like, did you know that apples are the dominant source of polyphenols in the average American diet? They have about 300 milligrams of polyphenols per apple. Amazing. Yeah. So, I mean, a little bit nerdy there, but I think that for me, I think the big thing is communication, and that can encompass a lot of different topics around diet, around lifestyle. And sometimes it also translates to, what are they asking for, right? They're asking for that super junky thing, but what they're asking for is like a comfort food.
Yeah.
Maybe that means we go home and make a comfort food, or maybe we pick something healthier that fits that mold. Maybe what they're asking for is a treat, and maybe that treat is a toy. Maybe it's not, right? They want something special and out of the ordinary. Yeah. And maybe the answer is no. Like, you can't, it's not a treat anymore if we have it every day again. And so it's sort of like this ever sort of evolving conversation and striving for balance, embracing that some of these things are cultural experiences, they're rites of passage. And some of them are things that you can just leave to the wayside, and it's not, you know, it's not going to be something that's impactful. But like, my kids still go trick-or-treating. Then they donate most of their candy to the troops, right? So, but the trick-or-treating, right, that's a rite of passage. That's an experience. I think eating candy until you vomit is not a rite of passage, right? It's not something that every kid needs to experience in order to grow up and be a well-adjusted adult. In fact, maybe the opposite.
Yeah.
So we try very much to figure out where those experiences can align with our values, and then where they're incompatible, and then where they're incompatible, have the conversation about why, so that my kids feel like they're part of that decision making and it's not being imposed upon them.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's sort of, I mean, my last question that I have, and this kind of answers it, because what you're doing is you're teaching the kids to make their own decisions about nutrition. You're teaching them how to cook their own foods by bringing them back and making their own cake instead of buying it, which I absolutely love that idea. I think that's great. But because one of the other issues other than just marketing is, you know, you often have lunch days for school where they order in, whether it's McDonald's or whatever it is, or you have birthday parties and events all the time where there's cake, there's sugary drinks, there's candy. And I think that's one area that is very difficult because it's almost out of your control. You want to let your kids go to that because their friends are there. But at the same time, you don't want them to be eating that. But I think you've kind of answered the question. It's sort of teach them so they can make their own decisions when they go to those gatherings.
And part of it is also being prepared. So you're going to a birthday party. What are they going to be serving? So I just spend a lot of time texting parents of like, what can I send my child with? You know, my child has, we often will just couch it as allergies. That's an easier communication.
Yeah.
My kids are both overtly gluten sensitive and my youngest is also overtly dairy sensitive. So, hey, you know, my kids, you know, sorry, we've got this gluten allergy thing. I know it's inconvenient. What can I do? Right. I'm not going to put the responsibility on the birthday party host or hostess to accommodate my child. I'm going to take the responsibility myself. So I will send my kid with a cookies from home or a cupcake from home, some kind of substitute treat. And if there's a meal there, I'll send them with, you know, a packed lunch, have this thing, or I'll make sure they eat before they go, depending on the timing, so that they just sit and watch all the other kids eat pizza. And then they get their treat, so they still feel like they were participating in the birthday party. And birthday parties typically also have some other fun thing, painting faces or a magician or a trampoline place or a rock climbing wall, like whatever, like there's so many different options now. So they get to participate in another thing that wasn't centered around food. And so I think that, you know, part of that is where can I substitute this for a healthier option? And that requires planning ahead. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn. There was, when we first started changing our diet, my kids were not quite 5 and not quite 2. And so we were in the like playdate central time of their lives. And we would go to playdates and then they would kind of run late and then it would start to be mealtime. And then they would start preparing some food and then my kids couldn't eat that food. And so I learned very quickly that I need to have like a little mini pantry in my car at all times for, you know, oh yeah. And sometimes it would be something would surprise us. Oh, everybody at this play date are eating cookies. So having that conversation with my kids of, yeah, that looked yummy to me too. I'm feeling like I'm missing out too. You know, it's an awful feeling and being able to engage on the emotional side, because what's happening right now that's so challenging for families is that eating healthy makes you the weird person, right? It's ostracizing in a way all by itself. So how do you communicate around those emotions with kids? And then how do you compensate to be able to hopefully bring them back into those sort of societal structures, and not feel like they're an outsider, but without compromising too much on the dietary choices. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a sort of constant challenge type of troubleshoot. It's always a moving target. It's different with every grade and with every age of like every year, it's a little bit different. How do they handle birthdays at the school this year? How do they, you know, what kids are, what kind of, what's the hot trendy birthday party my kids are getting invited to this year? How does, you know, I've got a middle schooler. How is the social dynamic different for her compared to for her little sister who's still in elementary school? And I imagine when we get high school, it's going to be a whole other set of challenges. And so I'm just doing my best to empower them with knowledge, support them in good decision-making, and understand that there is an emotional side to this. And there is also sometimes making a not good decision is the right decision, if that makes any sense, right? Yeah. Sometimes that choice that was obviously not the best choice for your body was actually the best choice for the situation. And also, so then it's also teaching my kids how to recover from a bad food choice. That's also a life skill. So trying to view it all from this lens of at some point they're going to be independent adults, and I want them to have the best skill set and the best knowledge to be able to maintain their health when they get there.
I mean, you know what, it's awesome advice, by the way, but it's the same struggle as you talk about that. I think about it, and it's the same struggle as, you know, a kid as it is for us as adults, right? Like, you know, I go out with friends and I know we're going to be eating crappy food or we're going to be drinking a lot. And so I have to try and do the same thing, and that's prepare before. And so a lot of times when we go out, I'll eat before I go, and then I won't eat when I'm there because I've already fed myself. And so, you know, I guess I didn't really realize it, but all the same rules and the things that I practice apply to your kids as well, right? And so it's really up to you, I think, to sort of practice them yourself and be a role model so that they can learn it.
The harder thing is the emotional processing for kids, because we can take that deprivation, but we really understand why we're doing it, right? We understand that the benefits outweigh that emotion at the time, and kids don't always have that same ability to process emotions, which is why the communication becomes so important. So my kid doesn't necessarily, especially when they were younger, it's not as true anymore, but especially in the early days, they didn't understand why missing out on a food was better than eating that food and having a stomach ache later, right? So like it wasn't an obvious line of logical thinking for them.
I have a good buddy that still doesn't realize that. So when you said that, I just couldn't stop laughing, because every time he eats too much, shit, he'll just lie on the couch and he can't handle it.
I had binge eating disorder. That's something that's been in my background. So I get it. Some of these life lessons are even challenging for adults to learn. It's my hope that by trying to encourage my kids to figure these things out now, that they will have it all figured out when they're adults, right? Yeah. They're going to make great choices and super responsible and do awesome things with their lives. That's the goal. We can only hope.
So listen, I have one question for you that I ask all my guests at the end, but before I do, I just want to know, is there anything else that we've missed that you feel that you need to share? Anything else that you need to touch on before I ask that? I know we've covered a lot
today. We've covered a lot. I mean, I guess the thing to reinforce is, you know, when we're doing this like health transformation, we're transforming our diet and lifestyle, we're getting this education and we're making changes and we're being very assertive with our health, right? I'm going to do these things. It's very, very different as an adult to make those choices for ourselves versus impose them on children. And I think that it makes a lot of sense to guide children towards these changes gradually over time. Mm-hmm. We took about 6 months. I went paleo one day. Like, I just, that was it. Now I'm paleo. And then it was like a miracle. And I went off 6 prescription medications in 2 weeks. And I was like, all right, now this is just how I eat for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was magical. But with my kids, we took 6 months to transition. And then even with food, I'm still constantly trying to expand their palates and introduce them to new vegetables and new flavors. And, you know, it took, getting them to eat meat was the first step, and then increasing vegetables was next, and then figuring out some leafy greens was next. Like, it's this constant project of trying to expand the repertoire of healthy foods that they enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been 7 years, right? It's not a, I'm going to get there and then this will be the finish line. I don't think there is a finish line with kids. So just in general, just in general, there's no end. My mother-in-law says, your success as a parent if your children can afford their own therapy when they're adults. So I love that bar.
That's great.
But I think that, you know, it's very, there's this drive that we have as adults to get through that change as quickly as possible and make these new habits and just be there. And with children, that's not always, I think it's very unusually the best approach.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to break this apart into smaller goals and then do it with compassion. I did a mix of sort of accommodating my children's preferences. So for example, my kids, their favorite vegetables are steamed broccoli and steamed green beans. And even now we have one or the other every single night for dinner. No, that's not true. lettuce has become part of the three rotation. So one of those three green vegetables every night. There's usually two or three different vegetables at dinner, so there's something else as well. But one of those, that's their favorites. And I still make one of them every single night. I very rarely eat them because I'm so sick and tired of steam. I can eat lettuce all day, but steam vegetables. Yeah. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a combination. You love that? Okay, I'll make that for you. A little bit of challenging, right? Like expanding their palates. Familiarity is really important here. So we have the one bite rule. Every time I make Brussels sprouts, they have to have, now they have to have a whole Brussels sprout. We've upped the ante from one bite. But that's how they have developed a liking for a lot of new foods, is like being able to anticipate the flavor actually increases our enjoyment of the flavor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a mix of that. It was a mix of gamification, a mix of bribery. eat that thing and then you can have this thing, right? And every once in a while, I was not a cool parent and I got angry and frustrated. And it's not like it's been a perfect, wonderful, linear, straight up. And so I think that having that expectation that it's a journey with maybe no destination, but we can sort of break things up into pieces and slowly ease our kids into this healthier life with a lot of communication, I think that makes a lot more sense, unless you're dealing with a situation where there's some kind of overt health issue that really requires a dietary intervention right now, right? That's obviously a separate situation, but when it's just lifelong health and habits, there's no rush, right? We're talking about learning how to make the best decisions for the rest of our lives. And that is not something that just happens overnight.
Enjoy the process. That's really what it's all about. Okay. So before I ask this question, if the listeners here want to learn more from you, where do they find you on the interweb, or anywhere else that they can find you?
Well, please only find me on the interweb. I draw the line at showing up on my street.
Well, there's books.
That's true. That's true. The books still have ebook versions, so they're still the interweb. my home central is at thepaleomom.com. So from there, you can link to my books, which are available in all major book retailers across the globe. You can also link to all of my social media accounts, but I'm at the Paleo Mom basically on pretty much any major platform. And from my website, you can also find my podcast, The Paleo View, which is syndicated and in its seventh year. Holy smokes. that's crazy. And you can also get onto my newsletter, which is obviously the best way to stay in touch with me, not miss anything new. Be the first to know about any other cool projects. I'm one of those people who has too many ideas and not enough time. So I'm always have some cool new things that I'm working on. So that's obviously the best way to stay in touch with everything I'm doing.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I'll put all those in the links in the show note as well, so that you can find it with just one click of the button or the finger, whatever you're doing. okay. So final question for you. This is something that I ask all the guests that come on the show. You know, you've been through a health journey now of, I think you said 7 years or 8 years it's been. If you were to go back to the very beginning, forget everything you currently know, what would be the one piece of advice that you would want to tell yourself before you restart it all? What would be the one thing you'd want to know?
Oh, that's such a great question. I really can only pick one thing.
Yeah, just one.
Just one.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
I know. No. It's because I think that, so I'll often talk about, you know, like if I had understood the importance of diet in my health 20 years earlier, or if I'd understood what stress was doing to my health 20 years earlier, that would have completely changed my trajectory. And even though I went through some really horrific experiences, that did bring me to where I am now, where I feel like I am making a measurable difference in people's lives. And so I try very hard not to regret any of it. So I think if I could go back and say one thing, I think I would say, it's going to be okay. There's another side and you're going to get through this. I think that is the one thing that I would have needed to know from my future self. Like, hey, heads up, the next couple of decades are going to be terrible and awful, and you're going to be miserable a lot of the time, but there's another side where it's going to be worth it. And mm-hmm. you're going to look back on those experiences and see the value in them. So hang tight. I think that is my one thing. My one thing is just like a little note of there is another side and it's going to suck for a while. But you'll get through it.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people need to hear that, because that the mental side of it is probably the hardest thing. So, I mean, hearing that I think is so important. So thank you for sharing that. And you know what? Thank you for joining me on this podcast. Sarah, this was absolutely amazing. Everything that I wanted it to be. Learned so much throughout it. And, you know, I'm just thankful that you were able to come on here and find some time to share this for us. So, you know, all the best to you moving forward. But again, thank you for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you again for having me. This was really fun.
Hey, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Health Simple Show. More importantly, I hope you learned something from it. If you did, leave me a review on iTunes. It would mean the world to me.